Hello and welcome to the February 2026 edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynmouth area talking newspaper's monthly magazine. I'm Camilla Taylor. Let us find out what we have in store for you this month. John Townsend will be in conversation with Marilyn Adams. This will be followed by a piece of music of her choice. Fran Frank has put together another set of 10 quiz questions for you. The answers will appear towards the end of the programme. David Picton will share his poem entitled Coming Up Roses. Norma Ortey will be reading her story entitled Inheritance. Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor will be discussing the book The Island by Victoria Hislop. Roland Burroughs will be sharing another extract from his memoir. This one is from the chapter The C Word and is about when he was diagnosed with prostate cancer. Sue Smallwood will be reading an article about the former Royal Hotel in Tynmouth. Fran Frank will be back with the answers to the quiz questions. We will then conclude the programme with a piece of music. Here is John Townsend with his guest.
Hello, it's John Townsend again with another Performing Arts Devon Dialogues, where I get to chat with musicians, actors, singers, dancers, theatrical directors and more besides who work and perform both locally and further afield. Now, my guest today knows a thing or two about the amateur dramatic scene in this part of Devon, having acted in and directed countless plays and musical shows over a number of decades. If you've ever seen a show in Tynmouth or the Shaftesbury Theatre in Dawlish, the chances are Marilyn Adams either had a hand in it somewhere or actually performed in it. Even though she's not a fan of pantomimes, she's still found stewarding, helping with costumes or running a raffle. So a big welcome to our studio, Marilyn, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, before you tell us about just some of the things you've been involved in over the years, I always start by asking guests the question, how did it all start? I'm intrigued to know how and why you became interested and involved in amateur theatre in the first place. Is the stage in your DNA, or was there some wow experience that lit a spark and you couldn't resist throwing yourself into the dramatic world of am-drams? So, when, where, how, and why did you become stage-struck? Take us back to the little Marilyn back in the day.
Long time ago. I was chosen by Alice Cross to do a little play when I was 5 years old.
Wow.
With my sister, a one-act play, and I was a fairy, believe it or not.
Can I just say, this is the great Alice Cross who began the community centre that's still there, her name on it today.
It is.
Yeah, exactly, so she was quite a presence in Tynmouth in those
she
days.
She was, because I lost my father when I was 2 years old, and I think she took my mother under her wing and looked after the girls in the family. And that's how it all started. From then, I went on to doing Eisteddfod's school, the Tynmouth Grammar School. And then I joined the Tynmouth Players at the very start. Loved it.
Yeah, now I have interviewed Frieda Welton, who you know, obviously, because
yes,
she, I think, started the Tynmouth Players. So you've been in, probably she's directed you in a few plays.
No, but I've been in plays with her.
Right.
The late Christopher Bean and I can't remember the other
names.
Yeah,
this would have been in the old Carlton Theatre where the pavilions now stand.
Yes, yes.
So have you fond memories of the Carlton Theatre?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. I love it. I wish it could go back to that again. So
interesting the number of people who say that. What was different about it from, say, the pavilion?
The atmosphere.
Yeah.
Okay. It was just everything about a theatre.
Yeah.
Whereas nowadays,
right,
no, I'm not so keen.
But what about the Shaftesbury Theatre? That has a
I
a
loved
nice
the
place.
Shaftesbury Theatre when they had a royal box at the back.
Oh.
And I can remember that. But, it, you know, it's still a lovely theatre. I do enjoy it.
Good. And you've obviously been in plenty there. But before we get to some of those productions, you mentioned I. Steadfords. Would that have been verse speaking, singing, or actual performance
acting.
In play? Acting in
mm-hmm.
plays.
Yeah.
Right.
When I was about
30. Yeah. So you, do you remember the first play you directed? What would that have been, I wonder?
I can't remember. I know I did Key for Two in Sheldon.
Oh, now I think we need to talk about that play, because is it a farce, would you describe it as?
Yes,
very much so. And the reason I say, so you can't tell me the date when that would have been, do you think, when you did it in Sheldon, in the church hall?
It was in the church hall, yeah. But I had been in it previous to that for a summer season.
Oh, right, so you know it well.
In Teignmouth.
which is why you've chosen it to be on at the show.
No, I chose that and The Importance of Being Earnest, because I have been in that as Gwendolyn when I was a youngster.
Yeah.
Later on, I directed it with Maggie.
Maggie Campbell, who I've interviewed here. Yes.
Yes.
So tell us about when you're doing it. Is it in the summer at the Shaftesbury?
Yes, the beginning of August.
Right. And is it it's a good old, you know, farce that we will.
It's very, very funny.
Yeah. Okay. Oh well, yeah. That's a little advert to our listeners to come along to that. So going back then, you were saying directing. You've done a lot of musicals, haven't you, over the years?
Well, I've been in a lot of musicals, even though I don't sing, but the acting parts. And then I've directed Hello, Dolly! And Return to the Forbidden Planet, a couple of those. And then, of course, I've done the carnival shows.
You did sing in that. We both sang in that.
Well, it was a talking singing, wasn't it?
Yes, it's the song from Gigi, yes, I remember it well. Yes, we did that, didn't we?
We did, and we enjoyed it.
We did enjoy it, yes. And I think you've done some pieces here at the Strand Centre as well, haven't you? Christmas events?
Yes, Christmas shows.
Yeah.
I've done a couple of those.
Yeah.
In fact, last Christmas
I did one. So you never stop, really, do you?
No, not very often.
What is the appeal? Tell me why. I mean, it's quite stressful sometimes putting on a play, isn't it?
Yes, I think it's more stressful being in a play.
Being in it than directing it, do you think?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, you can sit back and watch everybody else, can't you, when you're directing.
I shall remember that. Yeah, tell us some of the plum parts you played that you were really pleased with.
Love being Gwendolyn in The Importance of Being Earnest. Yeah. And I enjoyed the part in Butterflies Are Free, which was the mother.
Yes, an American,
American
quite
play.
A bossy American mother.
But it was a brilliant part to play.
Yeah.
I enjoyed Stepping Out because I had to learn to tap dance.
Oh, I was going to ask whether you had dancing skills.
Yeah. No, not really. But I learned to tap dance. Paula Smith, she helped me with the tap dancing because I'd never tap danced before, but it was a lovely part. And so I was in that in Dawlish, Teignmouth and Sheldon.
Okay. Have you ever done Torquay? Have you ever done the Toads or?
No, I did one at Paignton.
Okay. We won't mention that. Okay. Now, I know that you recently, I think only a few months ago, you were at the Ice Factory in Teignmouth with the Teignmouth Players playing a formidable a huge amount to learn, the part that was originally taken by Thora Heard in, I think it's A Cream Cracker Under the Settee, isn't it? Alan Bennett monologue.
10 pages
to learn. How did you get on with that? Was it
loved every second. Absolutely loved it.
Yeah, so just to remind listeners, it's an elderly lady, shall we say, who's fallen and I think, can't get up again in her own house.
She was on a chair and then she slid down to the floor and sat on the floor for
and,
the rest
and she
of
does,
it.
So the whole piece you had to do sitting on the floor virtually.
Yes, I sort of moved.
And then you had to drag yourself. It's quite a moving piece because we realise she tells her story, you know, about her husband who was not really up to much, was he? And she speaks affectionately about
him. But it was
him.
A lovely part.
Yeah. Now, in that theatre, it's a very small, intimate space, and the audience are presumably right next to you.
Yes.
How was that performing?
I I didn't look forward to it.
No.
But once I started, it was so much nicer.
Yeah.
Because you could talk to the audience, yes, or you could tell actually, the audience.
Yeah, as though you
story.
Were telling them the story.
Yes.
And, you know, there weren't too many snuffles and sweet papers and things that put you off.
There wasn't any of that. But the last night I did it, there was a lady crying. So.
Yeah. Well, that's marvellous. I mean, if you can make some... Presumably for the right reasons.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it's a very moving piece, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, it's about the baby.
Were you close to tears yourself when you were doing it?
Yes, but I was concentrating on
words. Yeah, okay, yeah, right. But so that was a recent piece, and as I say, you're doing directing again in the summer. Any other plans that are on the horizon? Any thoughts?
Yes, I'm hoping to do something soon, but that's all under wraps at the moment.
Yes, okay, so. We mustn't divulge too much, no. But would you be tempted to do The Importance of Being Earnest again?
I would love to direct it. Yes.
Okay. Oh, right.
Or play Lady Bracknell.
Yes. Or, of course, it's now played by men very well. Stephen Fry played the part of Lady Bracknell in the movie.
Yes.
Not sure
and
how that
I
would work.
I actually went to see something called Ernest.
Yes.
In Exeter.
Right.
And they picked people from the audience because apparently the cast hadn't turned up.
Oh, that's
so the
fun.
Audience.
They had to take the part.
I was 18-year-old Cecily for the whole of the play in a pink Blancmange dress.
I'm sure you did it admirably. I have to ask this question because you've done lots at the Shaftesbury Theatre, and everyone tells me about this ghost called Esmeralda. Have you come close to Esmeralda at all, or are you one of us that say, nah, it's just made up?
No, I've never met her, never seen her, heard noises.
Yeah.
And somebody had a pair of earrings disappear one night that were green.
Yes.
And they never turned up again.
Right.
So whether they went with Esmeralda, I don't know.
Oh, well. Look, we could talk, I'm sure, about many of the roles you played and the Dawlish Musical Theatre Company that you ran for a long time, I think.
Yes, I was chairman for many, many years.
And those shows were also at the Shaftesbury?
They were.
Yeah. So carnivals in marquees, Shaftesbury, the Ice Factory, all these places you performed. Well, thank you for talking to us. Time is running out, but we always ask, have you got a piece of music you'd like us to play to finish with? And, well, why have you chosen it? What's your choice?
I won't tell you why I've chosen it, but Salut d'Amour is a piece that I really love, and I can play it over and over again.
Yeah, okay. So, well, that's a good enough reason. And, of course, that means love's greeting.
Yes.
Yes, your actual French. Yes, Salut d'Amour.
It takes
us back to our song when
absolutely.
I remember it well. Well, it just remains for me to thank you, Marilyn, for telling us about just some of your involvement in local theatre and performing arts, and best wishes for your next production and beyond. Thanks so much for chatting, but it's goodbye for now as we go over to Salut d'Amour.
You're very welcome, and goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.
You have just listened to Edward Elgar's Salut d'Amour, performed by Nigel Kennedy on the violin. It's now over to Fran Frank for the quiz questions.
Hello again. Here we are with another selection of general knowledge questions. If you are sitting comfortably, then I will start with question one. When telling the time, what do the initials AM stand for? Is it A, Alto Morgan, B, Antimeridium, or C, Absolute Morning? Question 2. A J.K. Rowling collection of stories for young wizards and witches was called The Tales of Beedle the what? Was it A, Barmy, B, Bearded, or C, Bard? Question 3. What is the name of the largest ice shelf in Antarctica? Is it A, Ross, B, Joey, or C, Chandler? Question 4. Which long-running ITV drama series followed the lives of firefighters at the fictional Blackwall Fire Station? Was it A, Ashes to Ashes, B, London's Burning, or C, Backdraft? Question 5. Which town in southwest France, with a shrine to Saint Bernadette, has a reputation for miraculous cures? Is it A, Lourdes, B, Vichy, or C, Tours? Question 6. Which U.S. state's official nickname is the Aloha State? Is it A, Hawaii, B, California, or C, Florida? Question 7. Common, little, sandwich, and Arctic are all species of which seabird? Is it A, garnet, B, gull, or C, tern? Question 8. Which rock guitarist or singer was a member of Cream and the Yardbirds? Was it A, Eric Clapton, B, Phil Collins, or C, Jimmy Page? Question 9. For what organization do the initials TUC stand? Is it A, Traders United Against Conglomerates, B, Trades Union Congress, or C, Transport Union Council? Question 10. Which spirit forms the basis of a margarita cocktail? Is it A, vodka, B, rum, or C, tequila? Well, that's the questions for this month. I'll let you listen to the rest of the program and come back again towards the end of the recording with the correct answers.
David Picton is here with his poem for this month.
My poem this month is about people that seemingly, no matter what they do, they always come up on top of things. They come up smelling of roses. And this poem is called Coming Up Roses. Have you ever known anyone who, whatsoever bad things they might do, always come up smelling of roses? Without a care or even a thought, doing those things they shouldn't or ought, and end up smelling of roses? Doing whatever they want to and say, and insist they get their own way, while coming up smelling of roses. Stepping into and out of deep dew, yet keeping their hands free of poo, and always smelling of roses. Living life on a whim and at ease, travelling through life on a breeze, enjoying their sweet smell of roses. If you know such a person as this, find out from this Mr. or Miss how they come up still smelling of roses.
Talking of roses, Valentine's Day is imminent. Do you mark it as a special occasion in your life? Do you go for the full bouquet of roses in a candlelit dinner? Or do you have the philosophy of celebrating every day as Valentine's Day with a loved one? Whatever your views, have a happy day without too many expectations. We now have a story from Norma Orty.
He stepped into the room and felt the mood change. It was no longer comfortable and welcoming in the sitting room. The occupants turned as one and stared at him. The eldest one gave him a wintry smile that certainly didn't reach his eyes. "Oh, so you managed to get here after all," he said. "As you see," replied John. "But Aunt couldn't get away and sends apologies." "Once again," replied his eldest brother, Peter. Peter's wife, Mary, jumped up and greeted John with a peck on his cheek. "Good that you are here. You're in your old room, as usual. It's all ready for you, and I'm sure you're ready for tea." After a long flight and a tiring drive, John was more than ready. "Thanks, Mary, it's good to be home." The third man got up from his chair and came to John. "Hello, little brother. It's good to see you." He hugged John and explained that his wife Joy was out walking the dog. "That mutt certainly misses his Uncle Richard. Sorry, Anne, couldn't get here. It was a while since they had come together for Uncle Richard's funeral." Stephen heard his wife returning and went to greet her. The three brothers had been adopted by their mother's brother Richard and his wife Joan when their own parents were killed in a car crash. Richard and Joan were childless and were a wise choice for guardians. Over tea and buttered scones, they all caught up on family news. The brothers talked about the wonderful childhood they had enjoyed and how their children were developing. "I was just a baby. I knew no other parents," said John. "What a handful we must have been." The peace of the summer's evening was disturbed by an approaching helicopter. Birds flew from the trees as the noisy machine descended onto the field. John ran to the door and called back, "It's the company helicopter. Anne must have managed to get a lift." The slight figure of his wife was helped to the ground, and the pilot waved goodbye and flew off. As they stepped into the room, the atmosphere changed again. There was a feeling of expectation, and everyone was more relaxed. "I'll call the solicitor," said Peter, "and he can come in the morning and read Richard's will." At 9 the next morning, Mr. Green arrived. He greeted them all. "Please be seated. This is the will of Richard Blake, and he stipulated that you all be present. As you know, his dear wife Joan died before him, and he inherited her extensive estate. To my sons, Peter and John, and also to their wives, Mary, Joy, and Anne, I leave my estate in equal shares, with the proviso that they find it in their hearts to legally adopt a child, girl or boy, who is in need of love, as such that we gave each other our sons, and received such love in return from them. It was a great shock and a complete change in our lives when your parents died. You looked so lost. We wholeheartedly took you into our lives and never regretted it. My prayer is that you will feel the same, and you and your own children will also benefit."
What an interesting twist to the story. We now have Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor with a book review.
Hello, listener. This month, Stephen and I have been reading The Ireland by Victoria Hislop, a sort of modern history set in pre-war, through the war, and right up until the 50s. Really, really enjoyed it, I have to say, before I start, because I couldn't possibly think of anything negative to say. It's well constructed. There's no confusion, despite all the Greek names. The research that this woman does, it's fantastic, as always. And the sensitivity of the Greek lifestyle, the personality. I mean, the personalities of the Greeks, she's done it so well. I know she's an old hand at it, but it still makes you feel pleased and gratified at the way she's made the effort.
Yeah, well, I think this is actually her first book. So she went on holiday to Crete in 2002, around that time, and she visited this little island just off the coast. It's called Spinalonga. And it's a former leper colony. So for much of the first half of the 20th century, it's where people who were suffering from leprosy were essentially dumped. But they formed a little community there. There was a hospital, church. You know, they had a little government, and obviously they had funding from the Greek government to run the colony. But they were isolated. They couldn't leave. And she spun her tale from that. So she's invented the characters, but the setting is absolutely as it was. And you learn a huge amount, not just about Greece, but about leprosy as an illness and the stigma and the misinformation associated with it. And of course, eventually a cure was found and the island could be abandoned. And it's essentially that story she's telling, but she does it with made up characters, a family saga that is very compelling.
And the family saga thing is always what carries some of these type of books. But the fact that it's a real place, it still exists. I think you can possibly visit it still. It's uninhabited. But while this story unfolds, she gives these people the courage and the capacity to make a life. Instead of dying, waiting to die, they make a life. They manage to produce crops and manage to sell, despite the fact that they have to fight to get the extra government support. They do. And as you say, Stephen, a doctor comes who's been researching a cure. And you think there is no cure for this. And of course, in many parts of the world, it's still a dreadful disease. But it's so well constructed. been weaving in and out of the lives of these various people on the island and on the mainland, and the fact that posh people are sent from the capital and they live there, and it's their money and willpower that drives this promotion of the island as a village to live in, not just to die in. And that's the courageous side of it. I love that.
Yeah, I think it's written with enormous passion. And, you know, I mean, it is extraordinary for a first novel that it sold 3-4 million copies. She just, you know, she launched herself as a novelist with this fantastic book. It's very, very popular. I think it's been made into a television series in Greece, and that has been hugely successful. But it's just, it's perfect historical fiction, because you learn a huge amount as you're reading it, but you're also swept along by a very credible and moving story.
And of the times as well, the various hang-ups of that type of living in Greece at that time, in Crete at that time, that's all included. There's nothing missing. The stigmas of daily life of women who didn't know their place and when stepped out and how they're affected. She's woven it so well. It really is a lovely story, despite its basic premise.
So next month, we're going to be looking at another well-known, relatively recent classic novel. It's by someone called Catherine Stockett, and it's called The Help. So if you'd like to read along with us, it's available on audio. Catherine Stockett, The Help.
Mary and Stephen have just discussed the book The Island by Victoria Hislop. This book is available in hardcover, paperback, and downloadable audiobook. Here is Roland Burroughs with another extract from his memoir. This is from the chapter The C Word.
Roland here, this time reading a chapter from my book, which, it's a little bit more personal. The NHS was and is the very best of universal services. It's an amazing, reassuring and caring provision. But it all seems to come down to those individuals. It wasn't until the autumn that I booked myself the appointment. I was feeling multiple anxieties because I'd just moved to a new home. I was in a new job and now I was talking with my new doctor. It was December. When came the confirmation that, although I do have an enlarged prostate, it's nothing to worry about and no more than any man might expect in his late 50s, as the unsettling scenario was thus explained to me before referral. Next, sitting with my consultant, I watched him do a couple of drawings. He mentioned walnut-sized, and I remembered having this visual image comparing my prostate to a shape more like the human brain. Then there was that walnut-like model on the consultant's tabletop. It stuck in my mind. Then came his matter-of-fact words, "And even though an enlarged prostate is a perfectly normal occurrence and could continue to grow slowly for decades before it becomes a real nuisance, I'd like you to have some more checks." It would seem that we could still reduce the swelling with medication. With me glibly thinking, well, that's easy enough then. He went on to say, "But I'd just like to make sure there's nothing more sinister going on. Oh, and I will ask your doctor to arrange a blood test too." That's when my imagination should have kicked in, but ever the optimist, I just assumed all was well and thought I'd wait for the next stage. The bloods were done just before Christmas, and with a healthy disregard for any urgency, results were to wait until the new year. An appointment with what I learned was to be the urology department came through for March. It was a bright sunny day, one of those lovely crisp spring mornings. I remember gathering my thoughts as I considered that at the age of 59 these things were not unheard of, nor even unexpected. but I doubt that anyone's day could ever be quite the same afterwards. Mine moved into a kind of greyness, like a steam bath, everything crystal clear all around me, but strangely muffled and out of focus. Did the consultant really say, "I can confirm you definitely have cancer," delivered with incision sweetness? "There are no doubts, Mr. Burrows. It's across more than half of each of the three quadrants." I snapped out of my fog. I had to focus. I needed clarity. I had questions. Well, surely I must have questions. What are they? What should I ask him? Oh, so much to take in. Lots to think about, but here, now, not next week. The next hour was one of my important improvisations. A new play was being written, all about me and what my options were. A life and death play with no minor characters. And my immediate thoughts? Oh, that weighty, unspoken script. How do I tell my girls, who've just all moved back to Cornwall to be closer to their mother, terminally ill with cancer? I was asked if I had questions. Did I? Only thousands. Which, finally, fear funneled down to just one. "Is it operable?" He suggested I speak to Angelica. She would be my surgeon should I choose to continue my treatment at his hospital. Luckily, she was free. We went directly into her office. Such a lovely lady. I remember she'd performed my biopsy, remarkably painlessly, considering they could only use a local anaesthetic, and the nature of that procedure meant it probably wouldn't be all that effective. Apparently the painkiller, she had so generously explained, didn't always hit the spot. I hadn't experienced any pain then, as she had been and had a very gentle approach, but it certainly had been a very odd feeling. She went through the details. I managed to obtain a perfect sample, evenly collected across all quadrants. Oh, good. "And so, Mr. Burrows, may I call you Roland?" I nodded, slightly numbed by the images crashing about in my head. "And so, Roland," she continued, "from that biopsy, we have a very clear picture. Mr. Ahmed has already told you. It's all very definite. Fortunately, this is very common, and we know it is a very slow-acting cancer and can often take many years to progress to the point of urgency. So you have choices." "Oh, good," I said. "It's nice to be given choices," although that didn't make me feel a whole lot better. She suggested I talk to others and steered me towards a consultant at Guy's Hospital in London, who in turn said I should also speak to another specialist pioneering some treatment using rods which responded to sound waves. I spent a month travelling around hospitals, speaking with those at the leading edge and asking to see their results. Results tell you a lot. Beware the physician bearing gifts of success. A younger demographic usually creates much better data. Thus, I learned to be analytical about these things. I returned to Angelica. I trusted her. I explained who I'd spoken with. She said that she would be happy to have me as a patient, but bluntly told me that her surgical procedure was basic, simple, quite crude, could leave me incapacitated, and was better suited to the elderly. She then added, "If you were my father, I'd send you somewhere else. If you're set on removal and not on a prolonged treatment, go back to Guy's Hospital." And so I did, although my heart stopped for a moment when I was stretchered to the theatre doors and greeted there by my surgeon, Mr. Dasgupta, who wished me well and explained that he would not be accompanying me into theatre. "Oh, no, Roland. The team will take very good care of you, but I shall be operating on you from a room down the corridor." the new science fiction age of computer-controlled robotic surgery, and even back in 2007, it was still the best decision of my life. Well, at the time. My open-heart surgery wasn't to be for another 12 years.
Extracts from further chapters of Roland's memoir will appear in future programmes. Sue Smallwood is here to read an article about the former Royal Hotel in Tynmouth. Any guesses as to where it was and what is in its place? More to the point, did you visit the Royal Hotel in its heyday?
In 1825, hotelier John Cockrum commissioned Exeter architect A. Patey to design a hotel in Tynmouth. It was built in accordance with Patey's plan and designed to blend in with the rest of the terrace already designed by him. The hotel became known as Cockrum's Coaching House, and it is said the name was changed to the Royal at the time of Queen Victoria's ascension to the throne in 1837. It became a very popular watering place. In 1852, Queen Amelia, widow of Louis-Philippe of France, stayed there with her three daughters to take advantage of the superior bathing facilities. Being a Roman Catholic, she was disturbed to find that no Catholic church was available for the faithful and, through her efforts, Joseph Handsome, brother of Charles Handsome of Handsome Cab fame, was commissioned to design and build a Catholic church, completed in 1854 and dedicated to St. Charles. In 1880, the South Devon Railway, later Great Western, wishing to remove the tunnel on which the church stood, commissioned Isambard Kingdom Brunel to design and build a new church, and in 1884 the present Catholic church was dedicated to Our Lady in St. Patrick. The original Church of St. Charles being removed stone by stone to Plymouth and renamed the Holy Cross Church. During this time, Queen Amelia's presence in the town brought great prosperity to the area. The hotel saw much nobility. Queen Victoria and Prince Albert are reputed to have stayed there when the prince went to Plymouth to open the original bridge across the Tamar in May 1859. Prince Edward VII found the town and its hotel to his liking and visited on many occasions. On one of his visits, he was accompanied by Miss Lily Langtry. He gave permission for the royal crest to be displayed, and until the 1980s, it hung above the main entrance. In 1938, the owner increased capacity by adding an extra floor to cater for the burgeoning leisure market, advertising direct access to the beach, own tennis courts, hot and cold running water, and modern bathrooms. During World War II, it was commandeered by the army and used as an officer's mess for the British Army until the Americans entered the conflict. It was then handed over for their use as the South Devon coast was used for training purposes. Sir Winston Churchill visited the troops in training and used the front writing room as his office to discuss the strategy of the D-Day landings. Dwight D. Eisenhower also used the premises on his visits to the troops. During the 50s and 60s, the Royal Hotel catered for business and holiday customers alike. The Rotary Club held their meetings in the hotel, and it was a popular venue for celebrations and special occasions. In September 1967, the Beatles stayed there during the filming of Magical Mystery Tour. The usual scenes of hundreds of screaming teenage girls desperate for a glimpse of the Fab Four were shown on all the news channels of the day. To give us an idea of just how big their ideas were in 1967, I've got a copy of a menu from the newspaper on October the 27th, 1967, And this is advertising forthcoming events for Christmas and New Year. It says, "Welcome to Christmas at the Café Continental, 1967, the Royal Europe Hotel, Teignmouth." And then we go on to list what we can have that year. On December the 23rd, starting at 19:45 hours, we have dinner and entertainment. And that's at a cost of 252 pesetas, which is 30 shillings, which still wouldn't help a young person, but it was 30 shillings per person. Christmas Eve, we had at 19:30 hours, dinner and entertainment with carols, and that was at a cost of 2,624 lira, which again is 30 shillings per person. Christmas Day at 1300, there was a cold buffet lunch at 16.82 francs, French francs that is, which is 25 shillings per person. At 1930, on Christmas night, there was European Christmas night and fancy dress. Now, I don't know what that cost because that's marked up as regret fully booked. Boxing Day at 12:30, there's luncheon, which is 8.78 guilders. That's 17 shillings and sixpence per person. And that night, Boxing Night, at 19:30, we've got Fiesta Night in Europe's Gayest City. And again, I don't know the price because it was fully booked. It went on, the advert, to advertise New Year's Eve, 67, Sunday the 31st of December, on the night at the Café Continental, 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. buffet, party and ball, including New Year punch bowl, and that was at a cost of 27 shillings and sixpence per person with strictly limited numbers. And for all reservations, you rang Royal Europe on telephone Teignmouth 5. No other digits, just Teignmouth 5. Angela Rippon, who originally came from Devon, attended a reception at the hotel after judging the 1975 Carnival. In 1977, the hotel was bought by the Wright family, but the domestic holiday market was already in decline, and in 1983 it was sold to what was then called Mencap. Its president, the actor Brian Riggs, decided the hotel would be used as holiday accommodation. Letters to the local press at the time show how divided the town was regarding use of this once royal hotel. The local council tried to address the concerns of local businesses and residents that a hotel in such a prominent position was not a suitable destination for Mencap's residents. The national press became involved, and the adverse publicity resulted in the Royal Hotel being boarded up for many years. McCarthy and Stone, developers of retirement homes, acquired the site in 1992 with a view to building 74 superior apartments for retired people. The council had hoped to be able to acquire the site for the benefit of the people of the town, with schemes such as a community centre, library and an indoor swimming pool being disregarded one by one due to lack of affordability. In 1996, the developers offered to incorporate, and I quote, a meeting or exhibition room, unquote, for use by locals. But by the time the plans were eventually passed, in February 1997, the offer had been withdrawn. Correspondence in the local press at the time showed that there were plenty of objections to retirement housing, as it would mean the loss of holiday accommodation, and didn't Teignmouth already have enough sheltered accommodation? However, it was agreed that the only way to prevent further decline of the site was for a large-scale business to be involved. In 1998, the first advertisements for the apartments appeared. One person living in the Midlands wrote to the local paper to praise Tim's foresight in inviting such a visionary scheme. Completion of demolition was finished in March 98, and in May of that year, the new build started to rise from the ground. In 1999, the first residents began to move in, although it was some time before all apartments were occupied. Residents agree with the deciding factor when Mr. Cochrane built his first coaching hotel on the site almost 200 years ago. All amenities are within a few minutes' walk. These days, the bathing huts have gone, but we have easy access to public transport and the pleasure of a sandy beach with access to a leisurely stroll along the prom.
It's over to Fran with the answers to the quiz questions.
Have you enjoyed the programme so far? Well, here are the answers to this month's questions. Question 1. When telling the time, what do the initials AM stand for? The answer was B, antimeridium. Question 2. A J.K. Rowling collection of stories for young wizards and witches was called The Tales of Beedle the what? The answer was C, Bard. Question 3. What is the name of the largest ice shelf in Antarctica? The answer was A, Ross. Question 4. Which long-running ITV drama series followed the lives of firefighters at the fictional Blackwall Fire Station? The answer was B, London's Burning. Question 5. Which town in southwest France with a shrine to Saint Bernadette has a reputation for miraculous cures? It was A, Lourdes. Question 6. Which US state's official nickname is the Aloha State? It is, of course, A, Hawaii. Question 7. Common, little, sandwich, and Arctic are all species of which seabird? The answer was C, tern. Question 8. Which rock guitarist and singer was a member of Cream and the Yardbirds? The answer was A, Eric Clapton. Question 9. For what organisation do the initials TUC stand? The answer is B, Trades Union Congress. And question 10. Which spirit forms the basis of a margarita cocktail? The answer is C, tequila, although I've never had one, I have to admit. How did you get on today? I hope you got most of them right, but if not, don't worry, I'll go away and find another selection for next month's programme. Bye!
Our final piece of music is called These Boots Are Made for Walkin'. It was written by Lee Hazelwood and sung by Nancy Sinatra. Released in December 1965, this song reached number one in the UK singles chart in February 1966.
For me, something you call love, but confess, you've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin', and now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Yeah. You keep lying when you ought to be truthing, and you keep losing when you ought to not bet. You keep saying when you ought to be a-changin'. Now what's right is right, but you ain't been right yet. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. You keep playing where you shouldn't be playing, and you keep thinking that you'll never get burned. Ha! I just found me a brand new box of matches, yeah. And what he knows you ain't had time to learn. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Are you ready, boots? Start walking.
Our thanks go to John Townsend and his guest Marilyn Adams, Fran Frank, David Picton, Norma Orty, Mary MacDonald, Stephen Taylor, Roland Burrows and Sue Smallwood. Thanks also to Jenny Horton for helping me with the copy and dispatch, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor and edited by Stephen Taylor and Mike Smith.